Hello, I'm Sam, and this is Pilgrim Pit Stop. It's a podcast about following Jesus through life's highs and lows. And there's a new episode every other Friday. So I would really love it if you hit subscribe and tell your friends about it as well, if you enjoy what you hear. Here's a little clip of what's coming up today.
And so what does it look like for us to grow as knowers in our knowing and coming to know as we receive and as truth discloses himself to us?
All right, let's go. Hello, fellow pilgrim. Welcome back to the podcast. It's wonderful to have you here. I am recording this on the 26th of January 2021, and in a few moments' time, I'm going to have a Zoom interview with Christy Mayer, which I'm very excited about. Christy is a research fellow. She's a lecturer in philosophy, ethics, and apologetics at Oak Hill College, and she has authored two books, More Truth, which came out in 2019 and which I would highly, highly recommend, and Healthy Faith and the Coronavirus Crisis, that came out in 2020. And she also co-hosts a podcast herself called Pep Talk, which stands for Persuasive Evangelism Podcast. Really excited to have a chat with Christy, and we're going to be chatting about some big stuff. Christy Mayer, welcome to the podcast.
Sam, thank you very much for having me. It's a joy to be with you today.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. Something that I often start these conversations with is kind of going back to people's childhoods and asking whether religion or faith played a part as you were growing up. So I'd be fascinated to really begin this conversation there and hear about your experiences of religion as you were growing up.
Oh, childhood, eh? Is this some kind of Freudian psychoanalysis? Are you That's trying it. To see how much I was influenced? Yes, I am. Well, my childhood is a bit of a hodgepodge, really. I was born in Hungary to my mother and my father. And my mum, where to begin? So my mum was raised in the Catholic Church, and she was a trainee nun for about 6 months, and then she came away from the Catholic Church for a whole variety of reasons. But she kind of, I think I grew with an awareness of the existence of God, but not so much with the personal presence of God. So I used to go to bed, still do, and she'd kind of, we'd like say our prayers together at night, or God would be somebody that I talked to when I'd been naughty. But it was all that kind of language of distant God. I didn't really have any kind of construct as to what he was like or his personality in any way. So I think in my childhood years, I mean, religion, I didn't understand it as religion, which I think is to her credit. I understood that there was a living God, but I didn't know that he related to me on a personal level, really. So it was only when I was 10 we moved over to the UK. My parents divorced when I was quite young. My mum remarried, he adopted me. But when I was about 10, he tragically just died of a heart attack. And it was when he died that I started asking those big questions of, wow, well, if God does exist, then what does that mean? Where is my dad? And I became very angry, very hardened, and just started asking those big questions, really, of where is God in the suffering? Where is God in the mess? How can a good God exist when there is such evil in the world? So I think there was that, there was an awareness of God. And then I was very angry at God. And then I went on a little bit of a journey where I just asked a lot of questions to a lot of patient people.
And did you find that you had a period where you kind of moved away from God? Or were you always aware that God was there, but that maybe your relationship with him or your understanding of his relationship to you kind of changed?
Yeah, I think I never, I don't think I could say that I moved away from God, because I don't think I was really with God, so to speak.
Sure.
I actually think the death of my dad actually propelled me towards God, even though I resisted him. Because I just became very angry with something, someone that I didn't think actually existed. And I remember my mum just being very patient with me, because, you know, I just threw out all of those arguments. Like, I genuinely thought that she was shielding herself from the intensity of the pain by projecting her desires onto this daddy in the sky. And, you know, whatever makes you sleep at night, that's fine. But I'm the one who's able to actually properly sit into the full depth of this grief and experience that to the nth degree. So I'm the one who's being the bravest, because I can actually look reality in the face and say, this is really, really awful. And I felt like she was trying to put this religious veneer on it, which isn't what she was doing, but I just kind of was very much suspicious of her faith as being like a blind one that didn't really factor in all of the pain and the hurt and the realities in the world. And yeah, so I think as I saw her actually suffer, and as she kept being patient with me, I saw that it was more than just a psychological crutch. Mm. So yeah, I think that was the start of my paradoxically actually getting to receive more of God's comfort and the knowledge of his existence. But it was still in quite a big abstract kind of way at that point.
And presumably, you know, you went to church on Sundays, to Catholic church. What kind of experience was that for you as you were growing up, the actual, you know, being in the building and surrounded by the icons and...
Well, that's the other half of the story, in that my mum came away from the Catholic Church when she was still in Hungary. Well, probably actually it was Romania before that. And so when we moved over to the UK, we were going to a little parish church in the village where we lived. I actually wasn't joining her for that. She kind of went along to it. I was, again, every question, I lived it and asked it. I was like, well, can't you just worship anywhere? Why do I need to go to church? Very happy to stay at home on a Sunday. Thanks, mum. You go. I know you need it, but I don't need it, because I am spiritually superior to you. So, so yeah, I didn't really have much experience really growing up in church. It was when we moved after my dad died and I was 13, 14 that I started going along to a local Anglican church in Ashby, and great church. That's my home church. And yeah, that's where I was baptized and confirmed. And yeah, I think the youth group that I was a part of had a couple of very thoughtful people in that group. And they took my questions really seriously. Because, you know, you just know when someone's just kind of like trying to blag it. I mean, I probably do it too much myself. But I was just like, you don't actually know the answer to this question. And I'd much rather a sincere and honest response to this than trying to, you know, save face and blunder through with something. And I actually really admired their humility in being able to say, actually, I don't know, but I'm going to go away and think about that. And next week, let's talk about that. And I think that just built up the credibility for me and integrity of the Christian faith, that it does stand up to scrutiny and we don't need to be afraid of that. So that went a long way actually in winning me over to I guess to Christ, in that his followers weren't afraid to say that they didn't know something, that his existence wasn't determined as to their surety.
Yeah. yeah, it's a powerful thing, isn't it, to be able to say, I don't know. It takes quite a lot of bravery in a way to do that. It's quite a vulnerable position to put yourself in. But I'm always very compelled by people who are able to just say, you know, like, genuinely, I don't know the answer to that, but let's catch up in a week's time and maybe I'll have some more stuff to say about it.
Right. And that's where the conversation is, isn't it? It's not someone kind of projecting forth an answer and talking at someone. It's a conversation, isn't it, when you're able to kind of to and fro a bit and build upon ideas and discuss them at length.
Wow. So you describe your kind of upbringing as being part Hungarian, part English, and kind of a mixture of this. I think on your website you talk about it being Hunglish, our sort of upbringing, which I love.
I was going to say, I have to remind myself that people actually read these things. Kind of, I write them late at night thinking, oh, that sounds good. And then
it's on the internet forever.
Maybe later. Yeah. Someone will actually use that as a label.
Do you have a sense of how Christianity is perceived in Hungary as opposed to England? Is it a kind of a different discussion that's happening there at the moment?
Well, that's such a great question. I in some ways, I'm kind of out of it. In other ways, I think the things that stood out to me, particularly when I first came over to the UK and kind of being raised with a very wonderful Hungarian mother, is more like the cultural elements of how we relate in Christian faith kind of communities. And mainly, I think, I mean, maybe this will link onto something else, but the way in which we view truth is very different. So, for example, in Hungary, it's a warmer country. And if you're in a conversation and say you make a factual error, no one is going to point that out to you because they want to maintain the bonds of relationship. That's what matters most, is kind of loving that other person and honoring them in that conversation. So, you know, if it was a big, big deal and you cared greatly about it, you might go and talk to that person afterwards, but you wouldn't in front of everyone say, oh no, that's wrong, it's this. Whereas in the UK, I've noticed it's quite different, in that if you're in a group of people and you make a factual, you make an error, then people will say, oh no, you're wrong, it was this year, or it was this or that and the other. And to begin with, I took that as a, oh, they don't like me at all because they're correcting me all the time. I just get so much wrong. But no, it's just a different way, I think, of understanding and communicating truth. And particularly in a church family, that's what really stood out to me, was that even in the church context, this was how people related to each other. And it wasn't a sign of their quality of affection for you or anything like that. It's just a different way of engaging, and it communicates different values. But I think it's things like that really that stood out to me the most, was how we lived out our love and understanding of the Lord. And we can be quite different. And so even now there'll be things that I have to be mindful of, that because my mum is very much of that cultural mindset. And so I'll say something thinking, oh, she won't think anything of this because this is just, it's just face value. And she'll actually be quite hurt by it. And so I forget. But I think it's things like that, really. I don't think I could comment on the bigger picture because there's such a diversity, I think, of expressions in Hungary, but also quite a strong identity in different churches. There's a very strong kind of Calvinist church presence, and probably more so in Hungary than there is in the UK. For a long time, there was like a blending of nationalism with a Christian identity. And sadly, I think there's quite a bit of segregation between the churches. The Baptists keep to themselves, Charismatics keep to themselves, Pentecostals keep to themselves, Calvinists kind of keep to themselves. So there's quite a hardening, I think, of identity. And so in other ways, which is quite interesting, in the UK, I think there's much more generosity and kind of an intermingling between the different denominations and confessions.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned truth, which is, yeah. No, that's fascinating insight. into a country that I know, to be honest, shamefully little about. but it's interesting to hear your experiences. And you were talking about truth, which is obviously something that you're sort of fascinated with. You've written a book about it. This is quite a big question, so feel free just to kind of, well, I don't know, do with it what you will. But how has your understanding of truth changed over time?
Oh my goodness. How much time do we have?
In five minutes or less.
And how much will my understanding change in those 5 minutes? Hugely. I went to university at, obviously, well, I didn't take a gap year. It was at the age of 18. And I had very much the notion that truth is about analytic propositional statements. And if you can show me the evidence for it, if we can reason it out, then yeah, that's what truth is. It's something that's either evident to my senses, or it's something which is just a priori true, like 2 + 2 = 4. You don't quibble about that. That is just true necessarily. And I try to very much live my life like that as a precocious 18-year-old. And who was very attracted to philosophy and the big questions. But I started to see that actually began to erode my humanity in a number of ways, and particularly when it came to things like trust and confidence. And when we think about trust and confidence with or against certainty. And so I was very much like, you have to be certain of something to know that it is true, like 2 + 2 = 4, that is a certainty. But there are so many kind of ways of knowing which we cannot be certain about, because I cannot qualitatively put my mum's love for me under a microscope and look at it and say, there it is with certainty. And so I began to see how, well, actually it led to a little bit of a crisis, I have to say, because I didn't begin to see anything. I started to think, gosh, how do I know anything? And so how do I even trust my senses? I did have one of those kind of Cartesian strange moments where he writes in his meditations that, you know, in order to know that anything is true, you have to get rid of everything, and then you slowly reintroduce things. So he's like sitting by this fire and saw some apples, and you know, they are not true because they're not true. They aren't there. They don't exist because I have to start doubting my senses. And so you just remove everything bit by bit by bit until all you're left with is the I, and it's the I that is thinking. And so because you know that you are thinking, that's because that proves that you exist. And I had that kind of, well, do I have to remove everything then from my little bucket of truth? So I know that I cannot be certain about everything. But then how do I know with confidence that the things that I think I'm confident about are actually true? Actually, that took me on a couple of years exploration. And it's something which I began to kind of put the pieces together. But it wasn't until a number of years later that I think I received, it's something which the Professor Esther Meek in the States calls epistemological therapy, which is where we have this defective default epistemology, which has been handed down to us from modernity, which is this kind of 2 + 2 = 4. It's you can know things with certainty. It's about facts. It's not about values. It's about science. It's not about art. There are these dichotomies that we create in our knowledge, and we say that it's about the left side of the brain. It's not about the right side of the brain. So what do you do with things like those, like art, values, aesthetics, etc.? And so it was when I came across her work that slowly I just began to heal as I was reading about something called subsidiary focal integration, which sounds like a bit of a mouthful, but essentially it's like riding a bike, quite literally, in that knowing is like learning how to ride a bike. And so you kind of sit on the bike to begin with, and you indwell the clues. They're the subsidiary clues, and that you're sitting on the bike, you're kind of leaning forward, you've got your feet on the pedals, You're learning how to kind of balance. You've got a direction in which you want to go, and that's the focal point is riding this bike in a particular trajectory. But there comes a moment of integration, and you don't know when it is, because to begin with, everything just feels alien. You're focusing on those clues. But at this moment of integration, the clues no longer become the focus point. They become subsidiary as you indwell that, and you are riding the bike. In fact, it would almost be absurd to think, how are you riding the bike? Because to think that, you'd stop riding the bike, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Or it's like playing the piano or something like that. While you're playing, you're not thinking about how you're playing. You're just playing. And then if you start thinking about how you're playing, you think, oh, this is absurd and I can no longer do it. And so that's called subsidiary focal integration, when these clues come together in a moment of transformation and they open out. This is the key bit, is that it opens out into indeterminate future manifestation. So you know that you know something, not because you can put it in a box and draw the lines around it, but you know that you know because there's more to know, but you don't know what that more is. So like riding a bike, you can ride a bike, but riding an essential part of that is not knowing where you're next going to ride it. It opens out into these indeterminate horizons. You could ride it with several friends, you could go to this particular place, you know, you could go on quite a different type of terrain or a different kind of bike. There are lots of different options. So I think that actually was one of the key elements that helped me to see that I know that I know something, because there's more to know about it. And again, that was just transformational. Sorry, rambling. There we go. That's a little bit of my journey on
that was amazing. Yeah, really, really helpful, actually, that image of the bike, I think, in thinking about faith. So thank you for sharing that. Another thing that you've done a huge amount of Q&As around the country, especially at lots of university campuses, and you know, I imagine you get thrown some pretty difficult questions often, you know, about the Christian faith. I was just wondering what are the kind of the common objections that you hear time and time again to the Christian faith from students, and how would you kind of respond to some of those really, really common objections?
I've actually found that there are so many questions wonderfully that I get asked these days, that they I suppose they do come into kind of, you can group them and categorize them, but there's a wonderful variety to them that I can't always predict what's going to be asked, or the particular way it's phrased, for example. I think usually what happens is, particularly setting up some of the objections to Christianity in speaking on some of these questions, is that I try to pose it in such a way that it answers the desirability question. So it's I think at the moment anyway, Gen Z is asking questions of, well, how is this relevant to my life? What difference will this make? What difference was Jesus going to make to me, and you know, to the future, and to these big kind of issues that are going on in society at the moment? So I try to answer like the desirability question, and in the Q&A then usually hopefully what comes up are the credibility questions. So right, okay, I've now shown that I want the person hopefully saying, okay, I want this to be true, but how do I know that it is true? It's that Pascalian kind of make good people wish it were true, then show them that it is. And so usually in Q&A, a lot of the questions that come up revolve around credibility. And again, it's a question like, well, how do I know that Christianity is the truth?
Yeah.
Why is it not enough just for me to make up my own meaning? Like, why do I need God? And in particular, why do I need this triune God? And more specifically, why do I need the incarnate eternal Son of God? and the cross, etc. So yeah, I get lots of questions on how do I know that Christianity is true? Why is Christianity the only way? What about God and suffering, other religions? What else? I think they're the big ones, actually. Suffering, truth. Wonderfully, there are questions on climate change, there are questions on meaning, purpose, identity, but usually it's on the credibility ones, like evidence for the resurrection, historical reliability. Hasn't this just been corrupted over time? And it's just myths, fairy tales that have been handed down over the years and selected by men at a particular point. Isn't Christianity just oppressive to women? Yeah, I think they'd probably be the big ones.
And in your responses to those, are you trying to enter into a bit of a dialogue with the person that's asking it and really sort of see why, in a sense, they're asking that question in the first place?
I usually answer the questions which have been upvoted the most amount of times, because you have to kind of judge and discern, is this a question that everyone would like to hear the answer to or not? Sure. So I think that's one of the things that really helps, actually, because sometimes you get a niche, really articulate, quite long question, which this one person is really invested in. But if you're in a public kind of setting and you have hundreds of people in front of you, you have a limited amount of time as to how you can answer that. So I try and open it in such a way that I kind of say, oh, that's such a great question, if it is a great question. There are several things that I could say about this. Here's one very quick thing on that. Present what that is, and then say, but this is just the start of a conversation, because it is. Please stay around. We're inviting people into community to taste and see the quality of distinctive, redeemed Christian relationships. And so I'd really want to be encouraging them to stay so that I can chat with them, they can meet other Christians, they can carry on the conversation. So again, it's not that, let me talk at you in front of other people and download this information to you. That isn't how we come to know anything, really. It might be a satisfying momentary intellectual answer, but then what do you do with that? So I try to do a little bit of both, in recognizing it's a big question, answering an element of it, and then inviting them on into the conversation and continuing it in community afterwards.
Yeah, the community aspect is just so key, isn't it? And I sort of coming to kind of grapple with really huge topics like God and faith and truth, actually to do those things in community is completely central. And I think that's why church is such a beautiful thing for me, because it is that community of people just pursuing holiness and pursuing truth together in community. I'd be interested to hear, because you co-host a great podcast which I was listening to today, actually, on my walk.
Oh, apologies.
No, not at all. No, I really, really enjoyed it. Some really, really great stuff in there. And it's called the Persuasive Evangelism Podcast. I was wondering if you could kind of share your thoughts on how we as followers of Christ can be more persuasive in our evangelism, and what that even looks like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think part of it, and this is something which I continue to love about our Lord, is that he really encourages us to come to him with our questions. Mm-hmm. And those questions, they're part of our discipleship and life this side of eternity. I mean, then we will know, and we will see face to face, and we will know as we are known, which is incredible. But I think part of what makes me, anyway, reluctant to have conversations in which I bring up these kind of questions is because I can be afraid that I won't know the answer if they really challenge me on something. Or I'm actually afraid that I'll be found out in some way and my confidence will be eroded somehow. Like, God isn't big enough to handle this question. He can handle that question, but this question, whoa, that is a hot potato. And so I think one of the things that I'd encourage people to think about is, firstly, just what are your own questions? What are the questions that you find are not so much sticking points? So these could be questions that have been born out of pain and different life experiences and a whole host of things. But I think to identify what those questions are for ourselves first and foremost, and then to move towards seeking answers to those questions for ourselves as a form of pastoral care and as part of our discipleship, I think is fundamental. And I think it's when we do that that we see that knowing and thinking about how to love our friends well in giving a reason for the hope that that we have isn't about presenting kind of formulaic tropes or rehearsed sentences, but it's about an open, vulnerable life before the Lord and other people, that I think we kind of open ourselves up to then be able to ask our friends questions. And so I think it's usually you'll find that the questions that we're grappling with will be similar questions to the ones that our friends are asking or thinking about. And so I think once we kind of have received the Lord's goodness and we see that he does stand up to scrutiny, and while we don't know everything exhaustively, we can know truly, I think then we can start kind of saying to friends, I've been thinking about this question. Oh, do you have any thoughts on that? You know, how do you make sense of that with your, well, if it's atheism or naturalism or whatever it is, how would you go about answering that question? And starting the conversation, I think, from there.
And Jesus did that all the time, didn't he? He constantly responded to a question with a question. So it's clearly a powerful thing, yes, that we can do as followers of him, is actually kind of asking another question and not necessarily having that kind of soundbite that's going to just kind of completely end the discussion, but actually turn it into more of a circular discussion where maybe more questions open up, and then you can really start to, and that's relational, I guess, as well, isn't it? So you're then actually you're doing this stuff in relationship with others, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So it's not like there's a magic bullet, a silver bullet. If you say it,
if you say it, the world will just convert.
Yeah, exactly. As you say, I've just loved that reality that you know, Jesus asks over 100 questions throughout the Gospels, and zooming in on those particular interactions with him and the rich young ruler and others. Randy Newman's book, Questioning Evangelism, is just gold on that in particular, and thinking, oh yeah, well, how do we ask a question? And often we feel like we should be the ones presenting the answers, but actually being able to offer a question in response, as you say, just opens up the conversation even more and shows that actually I care about you as a human being. I want to know what you think. This isn't a download of information.
Yeah. More generally, in your wider reading, is there a book that you've read recently that's completely flipped your understanding of something or blown your mind in a particular area? Is there a book that you would want the listeners of this podcast to go out and buy and have a read of straight away?
Yes. This is the book. Well, it's one of the books actually that restored me to myself, and without exaggeration, changed my life. And that would be, it's called A Little Manual of Knowing, or For Knowing. I was getting propositions mixed up. By Esther Meek. And that is the kind of the short version of her academic work, which is Loving to Know, which is an excellent book, but you know, a few hundred pages longer. But A Little Manual is the kind of entree into covenant epistemology, and thinks about, I guess, puts on the menu things like wonder and awe and gratitude and these kind of different elements in our knowing processes that isn't usually accounted for or talked about. And so what does it look like for us to grow as knowers in our knowing and coming to know as we receive and as truth discloses himself to us? It's a beautiful book. So yeah, A Little Manual for Knowing, I think, would be the one I'd recommend.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Christy. It's been an absolute pleasure to hear from you and, you know, hear your insight in all these things. So bless you.
Oh, it's been a joy. Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Sam. Thank you.
There we we go. That was my conversation with the wonderful Christy Mayer, which I hope you enjoyed. I certainly did. There's actually a little bit more of our conversation I haven't yet released, and that will be coming out in a future episode. So watch this space. If you want to follow up on some of the stuff that Christy's been talking about today, I would really encourage you to check out her work, especially that book More Truth, which is just a banger, really. It's just a really good book, packed full of insight. Would really encourage you to check that out. Great. Well, many thanks, as always, to Johnny Davies for creating the theme music, and to Thomas Thorogood for creating the jingles, and to you, precious listener, for choosing to come along on this pilgrimage. If you've really enjoyed the podcast and want to show your appreciation, then one way you can do that is you can click the link in the description and you can buy me a coffee, which is just a fun way of showing a bit of support for the old pod. There will be another episode in 2 weeks' time, but until then, stay safe, God bless you, and goodbye.